Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon. What's up? End credits, y'all.
This isn't the Fru 93.3. Yeah, let's cut out the Zoo Crew stuff. But I, you know, you're on a high. I understand being a big basketball fan.
And... Oh, exactly. Go Raptors.
You were at the parade in spirit, but that's okay. Anyway, this is not a sports show, so we'll cut that out. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week could be the latest, and they say final, X-Men movie, Dark Phoenix. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to do something a bit different this week. We are going to revisit Tim Burton's Batman, which was released 30 years ago this coming Sunday. But first, as we said, Dark Phoenix is the last in the series of X-Men movies that started in the year 2000. Or it's like, you probably know all the old Conan bits, Conan O'Brien bits, like in the year 2000.
What about X-Men? No, I can't think of
it. Yeah, it was in the year 2000. In the year 2000.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You're supposed to be a comedy guy.
Sorry.
This episode has failed from the start.
I apologize to Conan as well.
he's heard your apology. But yeah, it's sad that after sort of 19 years...
It's done.
It's over. Well, I mean, it's almost possibly over. There's New Mutants that comes out next summer.
Is it going to be a film?
Yes.
Like, is it going to be a part of MCU or anything like that?
I don't know if it's part of the main X-Men, like, universe or not, because it's... I mean, the title, New Mutants, it comes from the comic book, which was obviously, there's an X-Men comic called New Mutants. And what it was like X-Men, like Xavier students, the next generation. The X-Men were like all adults. And then so the New Mutants were like the next generation of Xavier's mutant class. And then, but for the movie, though, it's like they're in a mental health facility, because people think they're crazy, but it turns out they're mutants. Like, this is what I've gathered from the trailer, the one trailer that's been released. It was supposed to come out in 2018, then it was supposed to come out this year, and now it's supposed to come out next year. So, I mean, it could very well end up on, like, Disney Plus is just something.
Yeah, or
something
like that. I think that, I'm pretty sure Dark Phoenix was the last of the, well, not anymore, but the Bryan Singer
franchise. Yeah, the one started by Bryan Singer in 2000. So, yeah, I mean, there is, like I said, New Mutants, but I don't know how connected with it is. With
That'd be great if James McAvoy and Sophie Turner and people do show up again. But I think also based on the box office, this might be the finale.
Yeah, it's second weekend is a disappointing fourth place.
Yeah, it's
beneath Aladdin.
Yeah. It's at $201 million, I think, and its budget was $200 million. So.
Yeah. And we'll get into the reasons they're in a bit later. But, you know, I find myself a bit disappointed because I think, for better or worse, this franchise developed in an organic way.
Oh, yeah. It was very well done. A very nice flow.
All the movies were nice.
Well, I mean, the majority of it was a very nice ride. Very nice.
Yeah, I think they were always entertaining.
It was
varying degrees of quality.
I think X-Men 3, The Last Stand, it has worse reviews than the first two, but I think it was a pretty great conclusion of the first trilogy.
My problem with Last Stand is that it's like, it hammers together two disparately different stories.
Yeah, it tried to shove too much into one film.
And yeah, they were doing Dark Phoenix, and they were also doing, I think it's like Joss Whedon's first arc in Astonishing X-Men, where there's a cure to mutation discovered.
And the whole Angel thing, too.
Yeah, although actually I didn't mind, like, that first scene with Angel with...
that's one of the best,
Ben Foster, I think, played Angel. Yeah, that's a great scene that sort of plays right into sort of the undercurrent that I think these films did really, really well, which is, you know, mutation as an analogy for adolescence.
That's what the first three did better at that than any other superhero film I can think of, or at least superhero series.
Yeah, there's stuff going on under the surface.
It dealt with discrimination.
Discrimination, racism, homophobia, all that. Mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, most movies won't, like most superhero movies won't touch. And if they try to touch it,
they stick to just the kids, like the MCU.
Yeah, you know.
They're great, but they don't dive as deep into very important adult things.
Yeah, there's no undercurrent, which is, you know, is too bad. You know, I think the closest we get is probably Black Panther.
Yeah.
Where, you know, with the character of Killmonger, there's very clearly some stuff you can dig into. But, you know, something like Captain America Civil War, where you could dig into
poverty, especially during the war part.
Yeah. Which, in Civil War?
I'm talking about the first Captain America.
Oh, they
dealt with poverty and issues of that nature.
But, you know, I think what I'm thinking about specifically in Civil War is, like, there was a whole story there about, you know, what is the appropriate amount of, you know, control and appropriate amount of, like, sanctionedness about superheroes. And, you know, how can superheroes use power, and where does sort of government control begin and personal freedom, personal choice ends? And that kind of gets thrown out the window around the time they have the big fight at the airport.
Yeah.
I think
there's like a small dip into it, but it's not like the X-Men, where there's a huge theme of it throughout the whole film.
Yes. And I think the X-Men movies did very well in sort of capturing the underdog nature. Like, X-Men has been one of the biggest books that, I mean, it was the number one Marvel book for pretty much all the 90s. But the X-Men story is essentially an underdog story. They're always being hunted. They're always being feared. They're always having to team up with the bad guys to fight a worse guy.
Well, because they're mutants, right? They are slightly different than superheroes.
Right.
You know, like Spider-Man and all those people, like, they have powers, but they weren't born that way. They're not mutants. They don't know what that was like dealing with it as a kid and such.
Yeah, I mean, this is where there will be future X-Men films. There will be completely different X-Men films, but they will be future X-Men films under the Marvel Cinematic Universe banner. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's sort of going to get lost, because when the X-Men are sort of off on their own, is when you can do the deep dive on, like, some of those things. But when you're sort of reminded that they're part of this much bigger universe, you know, you start thinking to yourself, well, what's the difference between, like, Spider-Man and Captain America and, you know, Wolverine and Cyclops? Mm-hmm. You know, because some are born with their powers and some, like, get their powers accidentally.
Guardians of the Galaxy already kind of started that too, right? Like, Chris Pratt's character is...
Yeah, he could be classified as a mutant.
Yeah, but he's kind of a mutant. Yeah, but again, they don't delve into that as much as the X-Men.
Mm-hmm. It's concerning that they're going to go into the machine and will be part of the machine. And I don't know if Disney can handle those, like, darker aspects.
No, it'll just be like... the second Avengers was, right? There was, I think it was Quicksilver who was in it. It'll just be like that. It'll just be like a regular superhero, I think. I don't think they'll have that much of a background or anything. It'll be more like Scarlett Johansson's character, where you see like a really quick glimpse back. They're going to do anything of that nature with the X-Men. But if they get any solo MCU films, you know, it might be like Black Panther, where there is more of a in-depth look into important things.
I hope so.
Bring forth those emotions.
But, you know, I think where Fox screwed up is that, you know, I've always thought it would be fairly easy to franchise the X-Men the way they would have wanted, the way they were trying to, by turning it into, like, an X-Men-only MCU.
Mm-hmm.
Because the comic books do that. You have multiple X-Men titles with multiple X-Men teams. You have Wolverine on his own. You have Deadpool on his own. You have X-Force. You have X-Factor. You have New Mutants. You have Generation X. And on and on and on.
Well, tons of their own cartoons too, the X-Men.
Yeah.
That weren't connected to, you know, the Spider-Man cartoons or anything like that.
Right. And it seemed like they were never able to capitalize on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was just so much, like, a change of directors.
Yeah.
And there was all the studio issues, right? Like, like Disney trying to get Fox. And I think Sony, something was going on with Sony too or whatever. There's just a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it's... They didn't. I mean, this is where you can't underestimate the force of Kevin Feige at Marvel, because he, having that one guy pulling all the strings on all the movies as the producer, as the sort of the guiding voice, and the X-Men never had that. But I also think that's to the benefit of the X-Men universe too, because because they had like very high highs with like Days of Future Past, X2, and then very low lows with things like X-Men Origins Wolverine. You get a studio that is willing to take chances on things like Deadpool and things like Logan. And, I mean, New Mutants was supposed to be that, too, that it's like an X-Men film that feels like a horror movie. But, you know, it's been in reshoots for 2 years, so who knows what it's going to look
like. Well, again, like Fox and things, probably just dealing with some studio issues.
And that's also part of the thing with Dark Phoenix, is that they were trying to launch this big summer movie, just as... the merger is finalized and they start laying people off out of the Fox marketing department, who of course are the people who are trying to market Dark Phoenix. And that's why it's kind of fallen through the cracks, but Disney has got like Avengers Endgame. They've got Aladdin, Toy Story 4, Lion King, you know, they've got four big things. And this is kind of like the big Fox thing for the summer is Dark Phoenix.
Sorry, so Fox.
I know. I feel so bad.
Hey, we saw it. We can't blame ourselves. We're supporting it.
No, that's true. Yeah. We're innocent.
Any person listening that hasn't seen it, you're one of the people whose fault it is.
Yeah.
So go see it. Well, maybe. Wait for the review.
Yeah, that's good. Good. That's a good tee up for later. But I feel like... you can't get away with just sort of winging it with the superhero films. And actually,
no, especially after what they've already created. Maybe if they wait like a long time and this X-Men's forgotten about, but...
I do wonder how long they'll wait.
Hopefully a bit.
I mean, we may get some hint of that later this summer, because there's San Diego Comic-Con, which I know Marvel Studios will be doing some sort of presentation. There's D23, which is the Disney-only Comic-Con in August. And if there's no presentation at San Diego, there'll definitely be a presentation there. They also have Fantastic Four they could do something with now, too. Fantastic Four was at Fox.
Yeah.
But, that's even more tainted than...
It's failed many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the first two made money, did they?
If they made money, they probably broke even.
Probably broke even, yeah. And then the third one, it didn't make anything.
No, I mean, and it was sort of like disavowed. this movie will self-destruct in 5 seconds. It's Fantastic Four is even harder to dig out of. And actually, Marvel the comics canceled Fantastic Four for like several years. Because like
they even in the comics.
They didn't want to deal with it. So, yeah, is it a matter of, like, maybe a few years or maybe a matter of 5 years?
I'm hoping, like, a good 5 years. And like I said, though, if they do want to do it sooner, I just want it to be, like, a Quicksilver or something like that.
Mm.
Just make them, like, superheroes. Don't dive into the whole mutant thing and separation and all those different themes that the Bryan Singer ones deal with.
Well...
Not just Bryan Singer, the other, you know.
What I was going to say is that, you know, maybe they don't have to... introduce like the X-Men, like they can introduce mutants in another way.
Yeah, that'd be cool too.
You know, I don't know, introducing like maybe Mike Allred did like this weirdo X version of X-Force where they're all the characters like weird, like in his style. He did, I think his most famous character is like Madman. You'd recognize the artwork if you saw it, but he, you know, or if they introduce something like weird, like the Morlocks, who are like these, like it's the society of like disfigured mutants that lived in the sewers of New York, just like something oddball like that. You know, I was gonna say if there's like future seasons of like the next Netflix Marvel shows, which there won't be, sadly, they could have like easily done like that would have incorporated well. If, you know, discovering disfigured mutants living in the sewers by the Punisher or whoever.
Well, also I just. Thought of this now. I think another issue is Disney, like their max is 14, right? If that, like,
oh, rated 14?
Yeah. I think that's their max. So, X-Men, I think, needs a bit above that.
Well, certainly what Deadpool proves is that, like, certain
or
characters
films like Deadpool,
can.
Deadpool, yeah.
And certain Logan is enhanced by it being allowed to go to dark places, PG-13 wouldn't allow. I did hear a rumor, and I don't know how much of it is true, but I heard somebody say that one of the thoughts about, because Stan Lee is passing, so there's not going to be any more mm-hmm. Stan Lee cameos, but it's sort of become a thing that you have like a cameo from this recurring person. That
yeah.
They should make it Deadpool in future MCU films.
I'd be very okay
with
that.
Would be an interesting way to introduce the like the mutant characters, but I wonder if Disney would go that far.
That's the thing. If Deadpool goes into the MCU, like the X-Men are in Deadpool, so maybe, unfortunately or fortunately, they will carry over sooner.
Well, I mean, I am all for that. I think that's a great idea. Like if you see in the background Deadpool.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it fits because the character's always breaking the fourth wall too. So, it, you know, in the same way that Stan Lee, and this is confirmed in his cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, is aware that he's popping up in all these places as different characters, including himself in Captain Marvel.
I'm curious if will one of his last ones be in the upcoming Spider-Man, Far From Home?
I don't know if he did one for Far From Home.
Oh,
I know
we'll find out.
I'm not sure if the Endgame was his last one.
But I hope
it
not.
Could be. Well, we'll see. We'll find out in a couple weeks. We're going to take a quick break and reset for more superhero talk. And this seems like the appropriate music. We'll be right back in end credits. You're listening to CFRU.
Express card.
Don't leave home without it.
Hey, get out of here.
Hey, let's beat it, man. I don't like it up here.
What, are you scared of heights?
I don't know. After what happened to Johnny Gobbs.
Hey, look, man. Johnny Gobbs got ripped and took a walk off a roof, all right? No big loss.
No, man. That ain't what I heard at all. I heard the bat got him.
The bat? Oh, man, give me a break, will you?
5 stories, straight down. There wasn't no blood in the body.
No sh. It was all over the pavement.
Famous last words, there ain't no bat. That was a clip from Batman from 1989. It's directed by Tim Burton, and it stars Michael Keaton, Jack Nicholson, and Kim Basinger. And it is the 30th anniversary of the release of that movie this coming Sunday, June 23rd, 1989. I didn't see it opening night, but I think I saw it the Tuesday cheap night. My dad took me, and yes, we had to line up.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it was Batman. There one was of the first major Batmans, if not the first major Batman film.
Well, there was the Adam West, Burt Ward Batman movie.
Yeah, but I mean, you know.
Which was pretty major. I mean, it's funny to think that for over 20 years, that was the Adam West, Burt Ward was like the predominant pop culture vision of Batman. These two guys in tights.
Yeah, he's still very remembered as Batman too. Batman and the Mayor from Quimby, Quahog, not Quimby.
Yes, Quimby is Quahog. The mayor of Springfield.
Yeah.
Adam West was the mayor of Quahog.
Yeah, still is. I think they just use. Dialogue but that's not important.
Let's talk about that. Before that, I played a track from the Prince concept album that was released along with Batman. They used his songs too, which is like one of the weird little aspects of this film is like the Warner Brothers cross promotion because Prince was a Warner Brothers artist. And so they're like, why not Prince in the Batman movie?
I did not know that.
Yeah, so that's why you hear Prince all throughout.
I wonder
Batman.
If after his death, the sales of Batman rose a teeny tiny bit.
Well, it's not his best album.
No, I know, but I'm just...
It's not exactly a Purple Rain.
I listened to the song right now, and I thought it was amazing.
I mean, it's there are some okay cuts, mm-hmm. but I mean, Bat Dance is incomprehensible. But yeah, it's you know, looking back on the film, you couldn't do anything in the summer of 89.
Other than that?
Without, like, referencing back to Batman. Everyone had a Batman t-shirt. Everyone was talking about Batman. Everyone was getting, like, the Happy Meal stuff. You know, that's the thing I was thinking about it today. That's the thing that you is missing from it, is that it takes place in the summer 89. None of those kids have a Batman t-shirt, which is BS, because they would all have a Batman t-shirt. And they would all be fighting over who would wear, like, their Batman t-shirts, so they don't look stupid each day because wearing their Batman t-shirts.
That's the most inaccurate thing about it?
Yes. I mean, just, you know, from the pop culture, because if you look in the background there at the movie theater, it lists Batman as one of the movies at the movie theater. And it just it occurred to me today, thinking about...
Oh, so
about,
they had rights to it then. Yeah, you're right. It's disgusting.
I don't know if it's disgusting.
Shame on you, director of it. Shame on you.
Eddie Machete?
Yeah, shame.
Okay. That was a bit too far. You know, you weren't born yet when Batman.
But it was one of the earliest superhero films I do remember seeing. It was on TV all the time, right?
Yes.
I think what stands out for it is, because we were talking about Adam West, it's kind of the first major Batman to really turn it into a dark direction.
Yes.
And that's where it stayed since then. So I think with Tim Burton really helped us out with that.
With quick divergence in Batman and Robin.
Even that has some... I was very young when I saw it. I did see that one in theaters. Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, he spooked me. So, you know, there was some darkness to it. But I know what you mean, yeah. But Christopher Nolan's trilogy, even the current DC ones, and the upcoming Robert Pattinson. It's Robert Pattinson. He's definitely going to be a dreary, more dark Batman. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Michael Keaton and Burton, I think, started that.
They're not bringing in Pattinson, the crack-wise.
Yeah, and Jack Nicholson's Joker is my favorite. Might even, I don't know if his portrayal is as good as Heath Ledger's, but I find his Joker more interesting. But that's what made a lot of people mad, because you see how he became the Joker.
Right. And it also retcons Batman's origin to making pre-Joker Jack mm-hmm. Napier the one who kills Batman's parents mm-hmm. instead of just like a random guy who is Joe Chill in the comics, and also in the Nolan movies, it's Joe mm-hmm. Chill.
Yeah, that's Burton's style. He took it kind of in his own direction.
Well, right? It was also very 80s style. Like, yeah. You can't be motivated to fight crime unless you yourself were violated by crime, and so it creates this... Tim Burton likes patterns.
Yeah.
So for Batman to create the Joker at the beginning of the film, and then it comes around to the end of the film, and you see that the Joker actually created Batman. It's like, I get it, Tim Burton. But there's in the special feature on the Batman DVDs, there's an interview with Sam Hamm, who is one of the screenwriters, and he goes, I did not turn Joker into Joe Chill. I want to make that clear. So he must have been getting, like, crap about it
yeah.
since 89 to mm-hmm. like 2005 or whenever they put this set together, but he goes, I did not come up with that was not my idea. Which I found
yeah very... we probably got a ton of emails and complaints and such,
you know, and well, it was probably before Twitter too, like yeah. I wonder if he's phone on calls. Twitter, and it was like
letters,
Joe Chill Choker, you mother. It's kind of yeah it's funny.
And Michael Keaton's phenomenal. I would
Michael
say
Keaton, who people beat up at the time for, like,
really?
His casting.
No.
Before they saw the movie. That was before, like, when it was announced was going to play Batman.
Well, what parts did he have before Batman?
He was known for mostly comedies, like Mr. Mom.
Okay, yeah, there you go. That's why then, yeah.
But, and of course, Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice was 87, and I think they announced his casting, like, in 88 before they were going to start shooting. But, yeah, he got pilloried, and again, before the internet... before Twitter, before social media, before Reddit and all that, you know, people were outraged. They were just outraged. And I think looking backwards, I think there's there's like a real, really a lot of appreciation for what he did, to the point where I've seen people talk online about if they're going to make a Batman Beyond, then they should have Michael Keaton play the older Bruce Wayne, who becomes the mentor for the Terry McGinnis.
That would be amazing.
He
currently works with Marvel, so I don't know if he'd be able to. But well, James Gunn, I guess, is working with both. So
yeah, there's crossover. Like it's
rising tide raises all ships. I think he is trying to move on too, though.
Keaton?
Yeah. Because the Batman was part of the reason why he fell down a bit, right? And then the whole point of Birdman and such was to...
Well, I mean, part of the thing was, like, instead of doing Batman Forever, he did Multiplicity. And But, I mean, he's bounced back. I mean, it's not like he... I was going to say Christopher Reeves. Like, Christopher Reeves never really recovered.
No.
I mean, he did a lot of theater and things. But, you know, he also did, like, Village of the Damned, the Carpenter remake, and with Christy Alley, which wasn't a good look.
We were talking about Tim Burton, and I just want to say I thought one of the best visual depictions of Gotham was through him. Like, he's so good at Gotham. Like, its whole shtick is it's super dark and scary and eerie and, you know, surreal, and he did that.
It's like Baroque and it's Gothic and it's like alive in a certain sense. It doesn't look like a real city because I think it was predominantly backlot.
Yeah.
I think it was at Pinewood Studios. But yeah, it's interesting because Schumacher almost took it too far because, you know, when you go into Batman Forever and you go into Batman and Robin especially, you go through these, like, pan shots through, like, this labyrinth of Gotham, which has, like, these intricate sculptures on top of skyscrapers that makes no sense from a design perspective. And
latex everywhere.
And latex everywhere.
Yeah.
So, Schumacher ends up taking, like, some of Burton's, like, core ideas too far. I think in Batman 89, you have a mix of sort of the fantastical Burton imaginary real world kind of thing, plus like just enough sort of hints at like real world, like the actor who plays the mayor in Batman has a sort of a vague resemblance to Ed Koch, who was the mayor of New York at the time. So we can get
attached to the characters, even though they're in a very surreal looking city.
And over the top too. Like when I was rewatching this last night, the scene with like Jack Nicholson and Jack Palance, where Jack Palance as the boss sends Jack Nicholson to the chemicals to make it look like they were robbed and so that they could stymie the cops. Jack Nicholson is just so over the top.
Yeah, I think he's good though. I think
he's good.
The Joker's
definitely
supposed
good
to be over the top.
Well, yeah,
and not all the Jokers, but wow.
Well, Jack Nicholson was definitely channeling himself. But
he's Joker's supposed to be insane, and that was his way of showing insanity.
And but it's the scene where he comes back as the Joker and he meets Jack Palance, and Jack Palance goes to go for his gun, and the Joker draws his and says, "Don't bother." And Jack Palance turns around and goes, "Your life won't be worth spit." It is so over the top, but it's so wonderful.
Yeah, it gets in your face in the proper way.
You could not do that in Nolan's movies, which sort of teetered like into deeper into the realism.
Yeah.
But I don't think like any comic movie you could like really get away with that sort of like hyper realism, that sort of over the top campiness. It serves a very tight line between what is dark and what is campy, and
I think they tried to do that a bit with Jared Leto in Suicide Squad.
Yes.
But that didn't turn out so well.
No, but
that might be the editing's fault, right?
It might be the editing's fault. It might be the fault of like all these rumors going around about him sending used condoms and diseased rats to castmates to get into the head of the Joker, which I think he's denied, but
yeah, but Joaquin's upcoming Joker looks more subtle. So he's not gonna be pulling a Jack Nicholson.
Right. It's they've been playing that trailer a lot at the movie theater lately.
I think it looks good.
I'm excited to see it.
I'm very excited.
It's I think an interesting take on the character and an interesting take on the world. And probably set itself apart from what has been done with like the Batman world before. Again, because it's also going to that realism, and actually it's also going back into sort of this time period.
It also looks like it's going to show how he became the Joker as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, more than like a 5-minute scene way. But it's going back into the 80s, which of course this was made in, and into that time period of like urban decay and rising crime. And, you know, it just makes sense that, you know, someone would go to borrow a CFRU show, Cuckoo Bananas, you know, in the wake of, you know, just living in such a hostile environment, which of course, I think Batman found new life in the 80s, in the comic books and in the movies, mm-hmm. you know, largely because of that urban decay. You know, it suddenly became very plausible that, you know, a family walking down the street coming out of a movie would, you know, suffer some horrible tragedy and thus cause some kid to grow up to be a bat costume wearing vigilante.
Yeah.
But I do, I think I cut myself off before getting too completely into my praise for Michael Keaton, because it's not just about the portrayal of Batman, because there's a little bit of a derangement in the way he does it. There's the scene at the chemical plant where he has like Jack Nicholson by the collar, and one of his goons puts a gun on Commissioner Gordon and, you know, says to Batman, like, let him go or I'll shoot Gordon. Mm-hmm. And then he puts Jack Nicholson down and steps back, and he has this kind of like this little like maniacal smirk.
Well, this Michael Keaton, I think it's in the second one, he kills someone.
I think
he ends up killing a criminal.
I think a lot of people die in this one.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, then
but
that's,
you're right. And,
yeah,
and Batman Returns,
very upset with
he
that.
Like actually lights a guy on fire.
Yeah.
Purposely.
Whereas in all the other Batmans, it's just he doesn't do that.
Right.
Even the Joker, he doesn't kill the Joker in Dark Knight, right?
No. Joker goes to jail, which it ends up being like the core thesis of the film is like this Joker's constantly pushing Batman to try and kill him. And Batman doesn't.
It makes total sense, though. It's Tim Burton, right? Like, it's got to have some darkness to
it. Well, I don't think Tim Burton...
He wanted him more, it seemed, as a vigilante than just a true superhero. But he might have been doing that in order to probably lead up to him just becoming a regular superhero. But...
Yeah, because it's supposed to be Batman, like, just kind of starting out. And it's... I also don't think Tim Burton cares about
what other
about the comic
think.
Books
exactly.
and things. And, you know, you can tell that by the acrimonious relationship he has with Kevin Smith, who cares a great deal about the comic book lore, and see that that history from working on Superman Returns.
I forgot about
or
all
Superman
that.
Lives. Was it Superman Lives? Yes. But like Michael Keaton in scenes, there's a scene there's a party at Wayne Manor, and he's just kind of like, he's walking around and he's got the pen in his hand and he sticks the pen in a cactus. And Alfred's like falling around, sort of like cleaning up after him. And, you know, watching it, you're kind of wondering, like, how much of this is like, is he like crazy or is he like multiple personalities or is he like just so into the show? Like, he's into Bruce Wayne as the aloof billionaire wacko.
He's also just a billionaire. That could just be how billionaires are. They all seem to be a little. Not deranged, but have some different tendencies to most sane individuals.
It just what I liked about this is that a lot of the Batman movies tend to ignore like the central premise that Batman is sort of what Bruce Wayne is, and that the Bruce Wayne persona is just that, his persona. It's like the reverse. Bruce Wayne is a mask that Batman puts on to, you know, in the daylight hours. And I think that's sort of where Michael Keaton is interesting, because I think everyone else from definitely George Clooney, Christian Bale.
I keep forgetting about George Clooney.
I mean, even Ben Affleck to an extent, because Ben Affleck spends an awful lot of time in those movies with his mask off.
Yeah.
I think Michael Keaton understands that better than most of the
Everyone else
the
is
actors.
Thinking about Batman, but he... was thinking about Batman and Bruce Wayne.
Right.
Because you're playing Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, but he's thinking about them as two different people.
Exactly.
And I think that's why Michael Keaton is...
more special.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least when it comes to that.
Right.
Although I'd say he's my favorite Batman. No
he's
offense,
tough to beat. He's tough. I think it's hard to...
I'm thinking of just singularly the Batman character. I don't know if it's my favorite Batman, but...
Yeah, it's hard to grade because I think there are so many different portrayals, and everybody, like, everybody plays Batman differently. Everybody mm-hmm. plays Bruce Wayne differently. And it's also, you know, you have a lot, you know, who knows what Kilmer could have done if he had done more as Batman or George Clooney and, you know, most of it, or, you know, Ben Affleck is playing Batman in these ensemble films, mm-hmm. not in his own solo film. So it's kind of hard to judge, too.
And it's different directors, and that's a large part of the film as well.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just, I guess it's just a personal one, then. I personally love that Michael Keaton.
He's great.
Yeah. Even the sequel. I think the sequel's great, too. I think Danny DeVito is phenomenal.
I like Batman Returns as a Tim Burton film. It's like,
yeah,
it's Tim Burton unplugged and unhinged. But we'll save that discussion for another day. We have to talk about Dark Phoenix next here on End Credits. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. It's a happy land, powerful man, universe man. Person man, person man, hit on the head with a frying pan. Lives his life in a garbage can. Person man, is he depressed or is he a mess? Does he feel totally worthless? Who came up with person man? Degraded man, person man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates person man. They have a fight, triangle wins. Triangle man.
You put us in danger, Charles. You put those kids in danger.
They're not kids anymore, Raven. And I care about their safety just as much as you do.
Are you sure about that? Because we're taking bigger and bigger risks. And for what? Please, tell me it's not your ego. Being on the cover of magazines, getting a medal from the president. You like it, don't you?
As opposed to being hunted and despised. Well, you know, actually, I do. It's all just a means to an end, Raven.
What end is that?
Keeping us safe. You should understand better than anyone that we're only ever one bad day away from them starting to see us as the enemy again.
So what? We wear matching costumes and smile in pictures
that
to make everyone feel
price
safe?
That is a small price to pay for keeping the peace.
By risking our people to save theirs.
Yes, yes!
It's funny. I can't actually remember the last time you were the one risking something. And by the way, the women are always saving the men around here. You might want to think about changing the name to X-Women.
Take that, mm-hmm. patriarchy. Anyway, that was a clip from Dark Phoenix. It's the new film from Simon Kinberg, and it stars James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Holt, Sophie Turner, and Jessica Chastain, who was wasted.
What, really?
This. I think so. She was wasted.
Who did she play? Jessica Chastain?
She was the alien leader.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean then.
See, you had to ask who was Jessica Chastain in this movie because she was in it and she was in considerable portions of it, but she did... No, I'm not going to say she didn't do anything, but she was wasted.
Yeah.
Like, dyed, like, whitish blonde hair and... Every action scene was her in high heels, which I thought we were past that after Jurassic World. I guess not.
So do you mean the character was like a waste?
I don't know if the character was a waste. I think having her, someone who's like she's a very dynamic actress, mm-hmm. who's really great at emoting and expressions, and I feel like she was wasted.
Okay. I thought you meant you thought that while acting she had been like drunk. Like reading.
No, not waste. No.
That's a mistake.
No. Her talents were wasted.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I totally agree. She had like no lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's maybe because she was a being that already is in the MCU. So maybe like for legal reasons, they couldn't delve too deeply into it.
I don't know. It's weird because
she was a Serpian or whatever they're called.
No, the race is like the what is it called? I wrote it down. Dabavi.
Oh, okay. No, that hasn't been MCU.
Which,
then.
Well, in the original Dark Phoenix story, the Dabavi are only notable for being the planet the inhabitants of the planet that Jean Grey destroys when she's Dark Phoenix.
Oh, so it's different. It's different.
So, yeah, it's what I will say is that in the scene where we meet the Dubovni, where they kind of invade that dinner party, that was a great scene.
That was a great scene. Right? Yeah, it was visually
like with them like coming out of the woods and you're not entirely sure what they are or what they look like.
Yeah.
And when Jessica Chastain as this dinner hostess investigates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a fun surprise.
That was a good scene.
I assumed it was us viewers seeing Magneto for the first time in the film and such. So yeah, it caught me off guard. And I, while watching, did not know anything to do with outer space would be involved. So
yeah, I mean, that was what was the big thing missing from the original chapter, or the original version of the story in the movies, which was Last Stand, which was...
I don't know if it was bad that it was absent, though.
Well, no, but I mean, it's one of those things that like sort of haunts the first couple of X-Men movies when Tim Rothman was in charge of Fox and he didn't want them in like blue and yellow spandex. He didn't want things too weird and he didn't want them to go to space and he didn't want like real kind of superhero-y stuff. You know, he wanted to like make it as cheaply and as, you know, without as much flash as possible. So for them to like finally go into space was a delight. I thought it was a delight.
No, see, I didn't like it. I thought the individual you just said, I think he more so did it for reasonings that we can view the mutants and the discrimination they're dealing with and just see them more as human and how awful us humans are dealing with them. And I think, like you said, I don't think it was for cheap reasons. I think it was more so he didn't want to make it a stereotypical superhero film. And I think that's why I loved them.
Well, I mean, there was no stereotypical superhero film. But anyway, that gets... But what I think I appreciate about this version is that I think the tone was sort of even. I think that Simon Kinberg understood the story he wanted to tell. I think that he was stymied because I've been reading stuff that they were going to make like back-to-back Dark Phoenix films and then they had to crunch it into like one film, so they had to cut some stuff. There was reshoots as well, like the original climax was completely reshot. And I feel like this movie didn't know how to hide the fact it was sort of cobbled together from like an original vision, a vision that was shot and then the reshoots. Unlike something like, say, Rogue One, which you could watch without sort of like the background knowledge of like all the reshoots they did on that. Mm-hmm. And you could see it as like a whole completed, well-made movie.
Yeah, it's a perfect flow.
Yeah.
So did you like this one or no?
I have a soft spot for X-Men, so
that's the thing for me too, yeah.
I didn't not enjoy it.
I didn't hate it, but it objectively was not very well made.
I think it's a better version of this story than what was in Last Stand.
I don't fully agree with that either.
Okay.
But at the same time, one thing I do want to say that I think, here's what I think. I think if you just want to see it because you like superhero films, don't. If, like me and Adam, you loved the X-Men film series, you should see it.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of callbacks to The Last Stand.
Yes.
Chess and little things of that nature, maybe a little fireball. You know, there's some elements that you'll, if you really like the X-Men, you'll notice it.
One of the things I geeked out about was they have Dazzler. I think Halston Sage plays her, who I honestly don't know a lot about, but as Dazzler, she was phenomenal.
Yeah, she was
like,
good
with the like the disco suit and the blue eyeliner and like the making sounds into lights and the performance at the little X-Men party they're having. Perfecto. I like that. I liked we get to see Magneto setting up Genosha, which in it's a bit different than in the comics. In the comics, Genosha was like originally like an apartheid state where mutants were basically slaves in their own land. It was a majority mutant population, so it plays into that like sort of real world allegories that the X-Men played with. But
it still deals with that even more than the MCUs do,
right? And but you know, in the movie version, it's Magneto sort of setting up a homeland, which plays into his, you know, background as a Jewish person who was rounded up during the Holocaust and suffered in a concentration camp and lost his parents in a concentration camp. And speaking of callbacks, this calls back to First Class because we see Charles Xavier resetting himself as he was in First Class,
yes,
as kind of like arrogant, as kind of flashy as seeing himself as like, I'm the mutant leader.
Yeah, he's in charge. Yeah. Yeah. He's got that charge back.
Yeah.
There also, though, was, I think there was some plot flaws, especially for Jean Grey. Like her, she's the one who kills her mom, right?
Accidentally.
And she's, but in...
That's a harrowing scene, too.
But I think it's in The Last Stand when they go, it's The Last Stand or it's, yeah, it's The Last Stand when there's a flashback to Professor Xavier and Magneto going to see her for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. And she's the same age and both her parents are totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then they take her. So that doesn't make, like, in that world.
Well, keep in mind
they... But then in the first one, X-Men First Class, they do go back in time and things change. They don't go that far back enough, I don't think. Oh, yeah, in Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
I don't think Wolverine fast travels far enough to change that.
Well, when did her parents die? Is like in the late 70s?
Maybe.
Wolverine travels back to 73.
Okay, all right. Maybe so, that's fair, I guess.
I mean, it's...
Did Wolverine go?
Butterfly effect, right?
Yeah.
But
well, so that means, sort of, Wolverine is a murderer of her parents.
Deep cut.
And also, I thought... The fireball thing I mentioned earlier, you'll know what I mean when I'm saying this. I thought that was really, really dumb. I thought that was dumb in the sense that it kind of ruined the conclusion the film had given. And but I do think right before that, it was a very nice conclusion. I think what happens or maybe doesn't happen to Phoenix is great. It's especially if you've watched The Last Stand, because it's it shows what happens to her shows that Professor Xavier sending Wolverine back. He got what he wanted. He comps it, right? Same with the character Mystique. Something interesting happens with Mystique. It's not a good way that her becoming evil was dealt with, but it was dealt with. She does enjoy Magneto.
Yeah. No, it's...
So I thought there was a couple things like that that were interesting.
Jennifer Lawrence clearly doesn't want to be here.
No, okay. That's another thing with these actors. A lot of them are not content.
And, you know, I...
James McAvoy even was a little... He was okay.
He put on a show, though.
Yeah.
Like, Jennifer Lawrence visibly doesn't want to be a... And you can see, like, by the fact they changed the Mystique makeup so that it's... Basically, they just paint her skin blue. There's no scales anymore.
Just all of the younger X-Men in general, I didn't really... Like, Evan Peters' character, Quicksilver, has been in, the last three. Yeah. And no character development, really. Honestly, not really any character
but
development
I think,
with any of them.
I think that's because of the reshoots, though. He couldn't come back for reshoots because he was doing American Heart, Horror Story. And I like Alexandra Shipp. It's nice to have a Storm with an African accent.
Yeah, that's cool. And she's in Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's phenomenal in that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's like,
yeah, so it's good to see her in a huge blockbuster.
There are a lot of great actors.
But not
for
enough
sure.
time for any
and
of
not
them.
Enough
and
time,
not
yeah.
enough character development. None of them really have their own kind of solo stories.
And I don't know if Ty Sheridan is the problem or the way they treat Cyclops is a problem, but it's... Yeah, like Cyclops in the movies I don't think has ever been well served, whether they're talking about James Marsden or Ty...
Cyclops sucks.
No, Cyclops is actually an interesting... Sucks. No, Cyclops is actually an interesting character in the comic books as someone who's like been bred to be the leader.
He's so lame.
No, he's not lame at all. He's actually
like a
brilliant
kegger or something. He wouldn't go.
He's actually
like,
a brilliant.
No, we gotta wake
in
up
the comic
early.
Books. He's actually like a brilliant tactician, which is why he's like seen as one of the great superhero leaders. But in the X-Men comics,
yeah.
In the movies, he's lame.
Yeah, he's
lame. In the comics, he's not lame.
Okay.
And I feel like that's like problem number one to solve in any future X-Men movies. Don't make Cyclops lame, because Sophie Turner as Jean Grey comes across in the beginning as someone who's like, she has her issues, but she also kind of has her stuff together too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, it's hinted at that she and Mystique, I guess it's like, the two most powerful women on the team sort of have this, because there's a scene where they're about to go off into space and Jean says like, well, you're kind of worried about this, but you know, if you say it's okay, then I'm okay.
Yeah, they're bros.
Yeah. So to speak.
Yeah. But that's literally right there. What you just described is the only scene that shows that.
Yeah,
that
no, and right. But, you know, it's in that, though, I'm not sure where Cyclops sort of fits in that dynamic, because other than
fit into any of the dynamics.
I mean, it's just he's kind of there because Jean Grey and Cyclops all have long been partners in the comic book.
Honestly, I don't think Ready Player One was a very good film either. So it might just be because of Ty.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's like can't remember if I've seen him in anything else. I might have. It could be just like a matter of him like being swallowed up in these CGI glob things. Because, I mean, that happens
with
actors.
When he was a younger lad, quite great in that.
Right.
So, yeah.
And it's not weird for actors to find kind of like get sucked into the morass of these big, you know, Natalie Portman is someone like that. Natalie Portman, I think, gets swallowed up in these CGI monster movies, whether that's Star Wars, whether that's Thor, and she kind of drowns in them. But if you know, you put her in something like Annihilation, where she's actually doing some acting, you see an entirely different actress.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's something we can say for Ty Sheridan.
Yeah, well, that's a positive of it ending, though. We'll see him in something else.
Well, that too.
I thought Sophie Turner was great in this, though. I want to say that. Yeah, I think she actually, there was more screen time at Phoenix. I thought she depicted it better than the actor from the first one.
Fomka Johnson.
Yeah, I thought Sophie Turner was able to show, she's not able to show all emotions. You
know,
but I thought she was the best at showing the sorrow and anger and stress of the Phoenix. So I thought she was great at that.
Yeah, no, when she... Michael Fassbender too, I think is
good. He seemed a little bored in this one.
But I think he seemed more active. At least there was a reason to have him in this.
Yeah,
there was a reason to have him in this versus Apocalypse, which kind of just happens. Mm-hmm. And they kind of have everybody there because they have them under contract. So why not?
I do think Apocalypse was better than Dark Phoenix, though.
Disagree.
Oh, really? Disagree?
I think Apocalypse... I think this had a drive and a vision that Apocalypse doesn't. I think that went quickly into development because Days of Future Past was so successful without really kind of like filing it down to the core of what they wanted to do with that character. And instead you get like Oscar Isaac in this terrible makeup going... I will cleanse the earth.
See, I thought he was great. And that character himself had development and, like, you know, I had feelings for him. So I think that's why I liked it more.
Except Apocalypse is one of these characters who's, like speaks in capital letters. Like, that's why they always get Dr. Doom wrong in all these movie adaptations. Because Dr. Doom is a character who speaks in all caps. Mm-hmm. And... You need a very specific type of actor to needle that thread and make it seem natural while also making it, you know, work on kind of like an over the kind of like a Jack Nicholson. But I digress.
All right, so if you liked Apocalypse, there's two people here, so there's a 50% chance that you'll enjoy it.
I mean, it's true. It's
enjoy Dark Phoenix as much.
I'm disappointed to see this series end because I feel like you get a lot of these sort of like middle of the road efforts. I think Dark Phoenix is a middle of the road effort. It's not bad. It's not great. There's so much on the line with these movies that to just be okay never really seems okay. But sometimes it's okay to be okay.
Yeah. Well, and it was like a 200 million box office. So. They were in now only 201 in the box office. So
yeah,
they had too much hope. They had too much hope. But again, if you're an X-Men fan, watch it.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll have to call the show there. Sadly,
all right. Finn.
If you liked this show, and we hope you do, and you want to check it out again, you can find us every Friday on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can download it from our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify.
And keep... Oh, sorry.
No, you have something to say.
I was going to say, also, make sure you keep it a part of your student fees. That email came out today.
CFRU.
So people, CFRU. Okay. Now you have to pick, so do that.
Yes. Pick it. Good. I'm glad you added that. Anyway, stay connected with us on Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter, where can people find you on the internet?
Mr. Tarak, a YouTube and Twitter.
All right, and I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or check out guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, and check yes, opt in to CFRU on your student choice initiative. CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.